This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This morning, live on WUTC, Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke joined us for a half-hour conversation. We talked about last night's city council meeting, the protests here in Chattanooga against police brutality, and the calls for systemic change. The city's budget shortfall due to the economic impact of COVID-19 as hospitalizations of new cases here in Hamilton County hit a new high, and more. Going forward, we plan to speak with Mayor Burke on the second Wednesday of each month and then share that live conversation here on Scenic Roots, as we do now with our conversation from this morning. Starting off with the city council meeting via Zoom last night, more than 250 people signed up to participate. I think certainly more than 150 got a chance, all talking about what has been talked about in the streets for the past 10 days or so. This went until about 1:30 in the morning. Did you see it all? And what's your takeaway?
My biggest takeaway from this is that I'm glad so many people are interested and engaged. I think this has been one of the true positives of what has happened over the last several weeks is people are engaged, concerned about the community, giving their feedback. Particularly a lot of young people are speaking up and activated. That's what we want, and it makes me optimistic for the future.
And then, as I said, this was 7 hours, and a lot of the same things that were said out in the streets. The 5 points of the protesters, starting off with what they call divest and reinvest. Divesting from the police department and reinvesting in Black and Brown communities. Also, the language of defunding has been used, as has been the case in other cities, which are considering those steps and more. Minneapolis, they're talking about dismantling the police department. There's a lot of confusion about what people say, what people mean when they say defund or divest and reinvest and dismantle. How do you define those words? Where do you stand in that debate?
Well, honestly, I think that it's best for me not to define what other people are saying and hear from them what they mean. And I think they mean a lot of different things. I don't think everybody means the same thing. And so I'm trying to listen to make sure that I understand what different proposals are, what different people are saying. What I think is important for Chattanoogans to understand, first of all, is that we're not new to this discussion. In fact, over the last several years, we've made very significant changes to police policies and culture that I think you've seen play out positively in our community for the last several years, and certainly the last few weeks. As our police department and our police chief have gotten great notoriety for their response to what is going on. We have reformed our policies. We, for example, do not teach chokeholds, do not condone chokeholds. That was before any of the issues with the unjust killing of George Floyd came to the surface. These were things that we've been working on for a long time. In addition, our police department in its training does community immersion, make sure that we are, every cadet spends time with marginalized communities. These are things that we've been working on for several years. That, by the way, just I'm sure you understand this, but that doesn't mean we think we're done. That doesn't mean we think we've made every change. This is a conversation that we've been having and we want to keep having in response to the questions of activists and the emails that I got and the Chief Roddy got. We instituted a new duty to intervene policy, which we did not have before these protests. And I believe from what I read, from what I hear, and certainly from every values piece that I hold, it's a good thing that we have this. If you see something, you need to do something and have that duty to intervene. And on the other side, we've also been investing heavily in neighborhoods around our community. That goes from a capital standpoint, building the Avondale YFD Center and the Southside Park in Alton Park, along with many other capital improvements, and also programmatically with everything from establishing a new homelessness services division, doing our early learning investments, making sure that we are putting race at the forefront with our Styles Hutchins Fellows in partnership with UTC and others. So I promise nobody who wants to make these investments more than me. This is what we've been working on. I welcome people to advocate for this, and we're going to keep having this conversation about how we keep people safe. That's healthy for our community and certainly our country. As you point out, Ray, this is a conversation going on around the country, and that is really positive for America.
And you mentioned Chief Roddy and duty to intervene. That was one of the 5 points put forward by the activists protesting. And also highlighting an existing policy of warning before shooting. Talk to us more about some of the things that you have signed on to in the past week. I'm talking here about 8 Can't Wait and the My Brother's Keeper pledge through former President Obama.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion of the 8 Can't Wait policies. These are policies that have been shown to reduce the amount of violence in the community. And we have did virtually all of these policies before the campaign began, or at least before I became aware of the campaign. And so one of them was a duty to intervene, which we did not have, and we have done that. The others were things like de-escalation strategies and warnings before shooting. We do have those. We've been looking at those independently, and also as President Obama asked mayors to do around the country, I signed on to the My Brother's Keeper pledge to review all those policies, because even though we have many of these policies, we also want to ensure that they're as strong as they can be. And again, I don't think about these as processes that have an end time, because as we learn more, as we experience more, we want to come back to these things that maybe even we already technically may meet the threshold of what people are talking about. But if there's somebody else who's got a better policy or a better way of teaching things, then we want to do that as well, because the goal is to keep everybody in our community safe, to ensure that people feel safe. And as part of that, you know, we've got to be willing to listen to what's going on and respond to the challenges of the day.
Another thing that we've heard from the activists and in the debate elsewhere in the country, including above all Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, are alternative approaches to policing, some of which you've mentioned, but community policing has been discussed a lot. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with some of the coverage that we've seen in the past week or so about what they did in Camden, New Jersey, where the police department, because of years of corruption, they did dismantle it in that case because it was something that could not be reformed. It was decided, and then you had a countywide force. Granted, we have the police department here in Chattanooga, and then you have Hamilton County Sheriff's Department and that divide there. But just focusing on the approaches of what
they began to carry out in Camden once they made an institutional change. I'm curious to know your thoughts on what they've been doing in the streets, because that has helped to reduce a lot of violent crime there.
Yes. So we believe in community policing. That's been one of our reforms over the course of the last several years. We have an entire division of the police department devoted to community policing. This is, I think, part of the, if you've heard me talk about violence and crime over the last several years, one of the things you know I say is that this is all of our responsibilities, and figuring out how we do it together is the best way that we can make a difference. As I continue to say, we there has been a lot of discussion about Camden. We'll keep looking at the different ways that people are instituting these things that we're doing. So, because if we can do it better, if there's a way for us to partner with the community in a better way, and that's more efficient and allows our community to be safer, that's what we want to do.
Another thing I wanted to ask you, and this is going to segue into talking about the budget and the economy under COVID-19. Time and time again, we heard last night from folks participating in the city council meeting about the percentage of the budget now spent on the Chattanooga police. I'm curious, off the top of your head, how much of that money is tied up in mandates, tied up in pensions, tied up in things that have nothing to do with how many officers are out in the streets and what policies they're following?
Well, we do have a lot of those dollars that are tied up into other things like pensions. We also have dollars in there that people don't typically think of as police functions, like several million dollars goes to McCamey Animal Shelter. That's part of our police budget. And so we do have both these legacy obligations, greater mandates, grants from other governments, like the federal government through the monies that we receive from them, that do make up part of that, alongside of our daily requirements to meet our staffing needs. So there are all these pieces in the budget, and we have our entire budget online so that anybody can go in, take a look at it, see what's in there. Just like any budget, it tends to be a little bit more complex than people may think at first, but that doesn't mean we don't also hear what people are talking about when they say they want, with the general, the various terms that you were talking about earlier, Ray, like defunding or dismantling or disinvesting, all those things. There is still a significant portion of our budget that goes to current day policing obligations. And I believe that we're going to need to continue to do much of that, because we also hear from many different parts of our community who have felt ignored in the past and need some kind of response when there's a danger. One example, of course, was particularly vivid last week when there was a gentleman on the rooftop with AK-47 as protesters came by, and our police officers went up to take care of the situation and arrested him. These are everyday situations that we know we need to deal with to keep people safe.
Let's segue to the budget. We are looking at an $8 million budget shortfall. This is driven by the state of the economy now, life under COVID-19. What are we looking at as far as moving forward on this budget? I know there's a process, but remind folks the markers that you've laid down in this process so far.
Yeah, so we cut a little bit over $8 million from last year's budget. It's important to remember that in a normal budget, just to keep things even, the budget would be going up because costs continue to rise. So even though we have higher obligations, for example, in health insurance and things like that, we have reduced revenues. And so that gap actually is a little bit larger than it seems, even at $8.5 million. So we presented the budget back in the middle of May, and the city council has had various budget hearings over the course of the last several weeks. The last night was the final step because, as you noted, there were a great number of people who've been involved in the protests who called in. The last step before adopting the budget every year is to hold a public hearing where anybody can speak on it. That was what happened last night. And so it is on the agenda for the city council to vote on the budget last week. One of the things I'll tell you is that because of the reductions, the police department did see a seven-figure reduction already this year. That was before, of course, any of the recent focus has been on the question of funding for police departments, and so did many of our other departments. So it has been extremely challenging for us to invest in the things that we think move our city forward, as we've done in the past. And Congress has been debating this question of whether to fund state and local governments so that we can make those investments, which we think are helpful for the economy and for the quality of life of people. And I'm going to continue to advocate that Congress help governments like us so that we can do those things that are really important to people.
And of course, Congress is debating, and at the same time Congress is debating, so are state lawmakers in Nashville. And that's another piece of all this in terms of moving forward on this budget and adjusting as the rest of the year goes on.
Absolutely. So we're continuing to, we have to monitor those discussions because we're worried that we could get further cuts in various places, our funding from the state. And so as they're in session, we're monitoring those discussions. It's a very challenging year because Chattanooga has been extremely strong. As you know, at the beginning of the year, Forbes said we were going to have the number one city for new jobs in the country this year. Our economy was going extremely well. We've been making these key investments. Our budget has been strong, and we've laid a great fiscal foundation. So my expectation was that this was going to be a year where we really could go much further and really expand some of the initiatives that we had. But we rely a great deal on sales tax and hotel motel tax. We all know that the travel industry and entertainment industry is struggling mightily. Our sales tax dollars obviously rely heavily on restaurants, which have seen a big impact from COVID-19. And so the money just isn't there as we had hoped it would be and expected it would be just 4 months ago.
And this happens at the same time where we have record single day hospitalizations for Hamilton County. And even with reopening in phases here, there, and everywhere, the concern remains about a second wave later in the year.
Yes, it's a very challenging situation over the last few months. We've had an economic stoppage, a global pandemic, a tornado, a huge unemployment, a big discussion and unrest from people about the unjust killing of George Floyd. These are extremely complex times, and it seems that many people have stopped looking. But yes, we are at a high for our COVID-19 cases, and also for the hospitalizations. As you note, Ray, one of the things that people are talking about is the potential for a resurgence in October and November. The reason for that is because that's the season where most people cough and sneeze anyway. And so typically what you want to see is during the summer, when the weather is good and there's less of the cold and flu going around, you want to see the numbers drop. Well, we can't really, if it happens, we couldn't really call October, November a resurgence because our numbers are growing now. And so we really need to make sure that we're getting this under control and listening to public health experts, because we don't want to start that season with high COVID-19 rates.
And those public health experts here in Hamilton County say that they're stretched thin. And while cases are being reported from all zip codes, once again, we cycle around to the parts of the population that are hardest hit, the most vulnerable parts, and those include some of the same Black and Brown communities that we were discussing minutes earlier on another issue.
Yeah, about two-thirds of our cases right now are from the Latinx community. It is one of the greatest concerns of mine that that the people who are impacted first by each of the things that have made such a dramatic impact on our lives, the economic crisis, the global pandemic, and the unrest because of issues with police departments. Those are all people of color. This is, I think, in large part why you see not only the protests, but also widespread acceptance and agreement, not necessarily with every point of the protest, but understanding and acceptance of the overall point of the protest, because this is a traumatic moment where many people are worried about paying their rent, about having a job, about getting the next meal for themselves and their families. And it's people of color and those hourly wage workers who are seeing the impact of all this first.
When we last talked, it was as there was a decision to reopen in phases from the governor, and we talked about you and Hamilton County Mayor Jim Coppinger. Before that round of decisions in this process, you were pretty aggressive in asserting how we should handle things for the month of May and into the month of June. Do you think we would have seen a different outcome now if County Mayor Coppinger and the governor had followed your view instead of where they came out on this?
Well, I can't really say what would have happened. I'll leave that to experts. Let me tell you what I believe is that the best thing that we can do, given the coronavirus path and knowing that it's going to be here for the next year, is as we reopen, my goal and what the plan that we had drawn up did was to try to create new expectations and norms for our city that said, this is just the way it is. You socially distance, you wear a mask, you wash your hands, and to slowly reopen so that you can establish that and make sure that as many people as possible are obeying those new expectations and norms before you open everything up. And I think that didn't happen. So now we have to find new ways to establish those norms and expectations. And that's what I'm trying to do now, I think, with my communications, with the webinars that city government's having, with all the different pieces that we're putting into place. But it is extremely difficult, as anybody can see, because you go out and it's obvious that those norms and expectations aren't there.
Because a lot of people are not wearing masks.
Because a lot of people aren't wearing masks. A lot of people aren't social distancing. A lot of people aren't taking it seriously. And our numbers should concern everybody.
And as we wrap up here, a couple more questions. How are you, your staff, and city government operating at this time since we last talked? And where and how do you expect to be operating as June rolls on and we roll on into the summer?
Well, we're still, City Hall is still closed. I'm speaking to you as I pace between two rooms of my house. And I spend 90%+ of my time in the house because I'm trying to, you know, make sure that we practice what we preach. And also, city government has a lot of employees. And as we come back, we're going to add to the daily number of people in our downtown and in our restaurants and in our shops. And so we want to be careful about that. We're going to start City Hall going back in next Monday on the 15th. We have extensive plans for how we create those new norms and expectations internally. Lots of employees have participated in how we do that. And we're going to start putting together all the pieces so that we open to the general public for regular business after the July 4th holiday.
And then, of course, if people want to contact city government at this time, where can they go online? Where can they call for the basic information to take them wherever they need to go?
Yeah, so I will say, based on my experience over the last several weeks, people haven't had a hard time contacting us, which is a good thing. We've seen contact like we've never seen, and it's been challenging, but it's also been great to see the expectation. So the amount of engagement. So you can always email me at mayor@chattanooga.gov. That's mayor@chattanooga.gov. If people have some service need that is bugging them or they have some question about, they can always call 311 or plug it into the chat 311 app. People are welcome to call My office, it's not always the most efficient way to get in touch with me, 423-643-7800. And then I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and we're seeing a lot of engagement through all those different platforms.
All right. Mayor Andy Burke, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. Good afternoon. I'm Richard Winham. Last week, following the outrage expressed by people in cities across the country and around the world at the abuse of power evidenced in the video of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, we reached out to several members of the faculty here at UTC, asking them to help all of us put the events of the moment in historical context. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Daryl Walsh. Dr. Walsh is a sociologist with a particular interest in economic and racial inequality. What are your thoughts on what happened in Minneapolis?
Well, I first appreciate the invitation to have this conversation. I think it's important to have serious dialogue. And from a social scientist perspective, there is a significant amount of social science scholarship that examines human behavior in society. And those of us who spend our careers putting society under microscope, we offer really, I think, one explanation. What we see happening has to do with systemic inequity, which is socially created. And we as citizens have created these social ills. And we as citizens can effectively respond to what is happening in society by just simply undoing what we have done. We created the social ills, and so we can undo the social ills. We have to have the political will to do so. I'd like to first sort of reflect back on an incident that happened, especially with a particular protest. And I want to raise a few questions to the listening audience. The NFL football player Colin Kaepernick protested peacefully. And here's my question to listeners and people who are analyzing what's going on. When he did what he did, taking a knee, what was your reaction to Colin Kaepernick's protesting about an injustice? Did you support it or did you oppose this method? In your mind, was he considered patriotic or unpatriotic? And when we put this under the microscope and we look around the world and other countries and we see people, citizens, rising up against what they see as an injustice, what we know in our society is he was executing his civic responsibility. He was bringing light to an injustice. He was speaking out. And so when you ask me a question, sometimes I always ask, when people oppose Colin Kaepernick's position, he was doing a peaceful protest. And then here we see an injustice that happened, and yet now people are outraged and they are protesting. And before I move on, I want to just sort of put this in another context. I want to illustrate. I think a lot of times people can relate to this. Parents. And I believe all listeners can relate to this scenario. And this, too, can, I think, be tied to personal responsibility. As parents, are you teaching your child to protest, speak up, and speak out? So when you tell your kids how to handle an injustice at school from another child, you tell your little girl, you tell your little boy that they should tell the teacher. And you as a parent expect the teacher to do something about the injustice. As a parent, when you see an injustice committed against your child, you use the chain of command. You approach the teacher. If there's no satisfactory resolution, you go to the principal. You use the appropriate chain of command to address the grievance experienced by your child. And some people skip the principal and they go directly to the superintendent of the school. But when I talk about that, here's my point. You expect the injustice to be corrected. You rally the support of other parents whose kids have experienced injustice and unfairness. You seek out anybody else who will validate your grievance of injustice committed against your precious little girl or little boy or your grandchild. The bottom line is this. You acted. You executed protest when you saw and experienced injustice. So, Richard, yes, indeed, what we see, the anger, and when we see the outrage following the death of Mr. George Floyd in Minneapolis, It has been expressed in riots across the country. But here is the ultimate solution. As a country, we as citizens have a moral obligation to rectify the systemic negative differential treatment committed toward other citizens. And each of us have personal responsibility. The responsibility to correct the blatant injustice. Any American citizen who sees that video and is not moved to act to correct our system in order that it will never happen again is wrong. Your silence and your inaction is contributing to the problem of injustice. And as a nation, I think that those of us who believe all men and women are created in the image of God, we believe all human beings have inalienable rights endowed by the Creator, and we are a nation that believes in democracy. When we have citizens that subscribe to Judeo-Christian traditions, we are believers, men and women of faith. We teach our kids, admonishing them to follow the golden rule, do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. And I mean, we can choose to do what is right, or we can choose to do what is wrong. And we as citizens already know the rule about how we are supposed to treat each other. We all absolutely, completely understand and acknowledge the sin of murder. And what we saw, police officer Derek Chauvin applied extreme differential treatment towards Mr. George Floyd. Officer Chauvin murdered Mr. Floyd. There is no excuse for his actions in taking the life of Mr. Floyd. And the other officers stood by and they watched. They did nothing. They were not moved. They didn't feel compelled to say, stop that. That's not right. You're hurting him. That's enough. So for listeners, Richard, many of the people, I think the listening audience, if they're interested in why this is happening, when they watch the news and they see the people protesting, and many of them might want to know how we as a society, how can we effectively respond? And I think in our nation, approximately a week ago, we all witnessed a murder in broad daylight. The onlookers in the aftermath are asking, well, what is going to be done to this obvious criminal act? Everyone is expecting swift justice. When the world watched such an inhumane act and they witnessed no response or a slow response to injustice, Richard, what I'm saying, people who saw the act as wrong, what did they do? They responded. They collectively started a protest. They mobilized and they conducted their civic responsibility. And for the listening audience who are searching for an explanation of why people are doing, the reason why the people, they are taken to the streets and they are screaming, no justice, no peace. They are responding to injustice. When we put this under sociological terms and we analyze, there's a lot of social movement scholars, and we talk about what moves people to protest. My question is always to those who are not joining the peaceful protest, where is your civic responsibility in reacting to injustice? We see these events happening, and they continue to happen. We're all at fault because we have not acted to the injustice. And you can protest in different ways.
You referenced the football player, Colin Kaepernick, going down on one knee. In my mind, that has become a powerful symbol. It's an action that's been repeated many times since, and so many times it seems in our culture that we respond more to visuals than we do to words. It's also in the story that we are all told of the country that Rosa Parks refusing to sit in the back of the bus was a tipping point. It was a moment when what had up to that point been accepted as the status quo was challenged and ultimately it was overthrown. Do you see the death of Mr. Floyd as a symbol and also a tipping point?
Yes. And Richard, in the social science scholarship, we know that racial superiority is a myth. It's false. we understand race is a social construct. The notion of race was invented. It really doesn't matter about your skin pigmentation. Skin pigmentation is nothing more than your what covers your body. What matters is the value that has been assigned to your skin pigmentation. It's how differentially treated, how we're treated based on skin pigmentation. We rank order skin pigmentation. And America has a track record and a history of positively valuing and differentially treating white skin pigmentation while devaluing, differentially treating in a negative way, Native Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, and African Americans, people of color, non-white. So it's this notion of whiteness and white superiority that has plagued our country. And there is a huge degree of denial. And there are many, many American citizens who have tried to connect whiteness as godliness and dark pigmentation as a curse and have used this as a rational justification and have allowed bigotry and racial prejudice to persist. And this false assertion and this false understanding causes divisions, and it separates us as American citizens from the eternal light of the divine creator. And so I think you mentioned the tipping point. We're at a point where we have a political will. It's my hope is that our country will repent and turn away from our tendency to devalue other human beings based upon their skin pigmentation. You know, I would say that we go through these cycles. America was founded. We went through slavery. Following slavery, we had a huge war, civil war. After civil war, we thought we had repented. And then we went through Reconstruction. And then we went through the 60s, the Jim Crow systems. And we're still suffering from being an addict, a racial alcoholic. And I think our first step to the road of recovery is to admit it. We as a nation are in denial of being a racial alcoholic, if you will. So when Americans, when we start the conversation, we have to continue to attend meetings and have serious, uncomfortable conversations. When all Americans, regardless of race, come to the meeting for dialogue, we must admit, I am a racial alcoholic. We as a nation must seek atonement, and we must atone for the sins that have been levied against Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latino Americans, and African Americans. We basically must denounce racial and ethnic inequality. And we will always be in recovery because we have an ugly, dark history when it comes to non-white Americans' mistreatment and exclusion, especially when it comes to non-white racial groups having equal access to the valued resources in society. Now, in this current situation, we're talking about equal protection under the law. We talk about law and order, but we must have law and order that's going to be equally protecting all the citizens. And then instead of inclusion, we see these exclusionary practices. We see institutional discriminatory practices in the judicial system, particularly the educational system, in the political system, the economic system, with jobs and pay. We see it in the housing industry and the banking industry related to mortgage and lending practices. These practices favorably include white Americans while excluding and creating implicit and explicit barriers for non-white American citizens. So I think in a nutshell, we're at another crossroad in America. In 2020, we have to repent. We have to confess the sin of racism. We have to ask for forgiveness for the sin of racism. And then after atonement, moving forward, we have to actually change our wicked ways. We have to be transparent in our policies that reflect the change. And that's where we are. And it's going to take all of us to acknowledge, to come together, to have some very uncomfortable, serious dialogue. And it's just like recovering from any kind of disease. We have to go to the meeting. We have to acknowledge that we have a problem, and we have to be transparent about the problem, and then we have to work to move forward to make sure that we can improve the problem. Once again, these social ills, they're socially created. Well, the positive part about it is they can be socially undone. we have to be honest and say enough is enough, and we want to do better.
It strikes me, listening to you, that and looking at what has been written and said over the decades, that this is a twin-pronged issue, that most people will sign off on that this is an ethical issue and it's wrong. Almost everybody would agree that the ethics of this are indisputable. It's wrong. But then it becomes, and it seems to me that the foundation of it is an economic argument. And once you start talking about money, people seem to find ways to justify the most outrageous behavior because it results in profits, or conversely, in a loss of profits.
In the political campaigns, we keep hearing about the 5%. Most of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few individuals. And people challenge that, but sometimes that's very difficult for people to wrap their heads around because, once again, you're very private about what your economic position is. And most of us who sort of we run in social circles with people in our same economic class. But at the end of the day, when we think about when we take the census data, when we take some of the information that we collect, most Americans are in the same economic plight. There are people who are well above. I think what we see people protesting for, I think they're expressing a lot of different dimensions of their life that they're angry with. I mean, people are working 2 and 3 jobs. They're barely making ends meet. But then you see people that are making extraordinary amounts of money. And, you know, if you work for a certain company and you are making a significant contribution to the company, but the company is constantly making profits, yet when the company is doing real well, the company doesn't really want to share those profits with all the employees. But yet when there's some downturns, then the company wants to start trying to eliminate any type of benefits. They want to cut back on the hours, that wages. And this is where people are also being frustrated, but they can't really find who to really protest against. And that's because I think, you know, economically, we don't really know where we stand. We just know that I'm living paycheck to paycheck, you know, and you might think about somebody else living paycheck to paycheck. So to your point, I want to, you know, class is the biggest issue, but it's these other issues that sort of people focus on. You know, we saw Occupy Wall Street, you know, that was where people were mobilizing around the inequality and, you know, how much people are, they're spreading out the wealth. I would say that that's some of my scholarship. I think that's really the big, big issue, but it's really hard. You know, they vote against their own interests. You know, they believe that people who are in positions of power and wealthy really, really are supportive of them. And yet it's very difficult to get them to see that they vote against their own interests. And they don't understand that there are policies that are basically being established that goes against their interests.
One of the roles that I think a teacher plays, I truly believe that I was talking to your colleague, Dr. Ward, and she said, this may be a moment at which real change happens, but we need a leader. Anybody who is in a position of affecting people's lives as directly as a college professor is a leader. Were you attracted to teaching? You said you're an activist. Do you regard teaching as an outlet for your desire to see social change?
I have an obligation to affect change, at least in order to improve or inform students. And I take that role very seriously. You know, I'm also a member of the military. I retired 31 years in the military. One of the socialization of all military people who wear the uniform is about character. And I think that's where, you know, when you talk about leadership, I feel like, you know, one of the ideas that I put in my syllabi is training for leadership. And I think we need to train our young future generation to be good leaders and have good character. personally, I think when we look at the character of our leadership and, you know, all the different levels, it varies. And I think what we really need, and this is another part of where we are in society, you know, it's about voting for character. You have to always ask yourself, is the person, the man or the woman that's going to be in this position, do they have good character? Can you trust this person with your children? Do you believe that this person will do the right thing in the wee hours of the morning when they're struggling with a very, very tough decision? You would want somebody with, in that position of power, in that position of authority, with good character. And, you know, being a part of the military, which was a, my training, was I always was impressed with my leaders because they always, I think I met many of them that had good character. And when we saw leaders who had flawed character, we had a way of removing those bad apples, removing them from command. And I see that on campus, and I see myself as a person who, you know, I know when I get up in front of that class, I lead by example. So I expect them to follow me, and I don't expect them to follow me when I got bad character. And anybody that's in a position of authority, anybody that's in a position of power, have to make sure that they have good character. And we don't want people who will abuse that power. And that's, I think, and that's where I think a lot of that frustration that we see out on the streets protesting is an example of that too. I think people are witnessing, they see things that happen in the church. I think they see things that happen in school systems. I see that see things that happen where, you know, members of the profession, they do not police each other. And that's where we have to do a better job, because I think that message, when we tell our next generation of children that people in positions of power and authority can get away with doing that have flawed character, and we tolerate it, that's problematic.
Dr. Darrell Walsh is a professor of sociology here at UTC. This is Scenic Roots on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nourabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.